Good evening, everybody. This is the People's School for Marxist-Leninist Studies. We're going to be talking about Lenin's stance against left communists and, more broadly speaking, the nature of the ultra-left as we have to experience it and deal with it in our current circumstances.
Left-wing communism, an infantile disorder. The struggle against which enemies within the working class movement helped Bolshevism develop, gain strength, and become steeled. First and foremost, the struggle against opportunism, which in 1914 definitely developed into social chauvinism, definitely sided with the bourgeoisie against the proletariat. Naturally, this was Bolshevism's principal enemy within the working class movement. It still remains the principal enemy on an international scale. The Bolsheviks have been devoting the greatest attention to this enemy. This aspect of Bolshevik activities is now fairly well known abroad, too. It was, however, different with Bolshevism's other enemy within the working class movement. Little is known in other countries of the fact that Bolshevism took shape, developed, and became steeled in the long years of struggle against petty bourgeois revolutionism, which smacks of anarchism, or borrows something from the latter and, in all essential matters, does not measure up to the conditions and requirements of a consistently proletarian class struggle. Marxist theory has established, and the experience of all European revolutions and revolutionary movements has fully confirmed, that the petty proprietor, the small master, parenthetical, a social type existing on a very extensive and even mass scale in many European countries, who, under capitalism, always suffers oppression and very frequently a most acute and rapid deterioration in his conditions of life, and even ruin, easily goes to revolutionary extremes, but is incapable of perseverance, organization, discipline, and steadfastness. A petty bourgeois driven to frenzy by the horrors of capitalism is a social phenomenon which, like anarchism, is characteristic of all capitalist countries. The instability of such revolutionism, its barrenness, and its tendency to turn rapidly into submission, apathy, phantasms, and even a frenzied infatuation with one bourgeois fad or another, all this is common knowledge. However, a theoretical or abstract recognition of these truths does not at all rid revolutionary parties of old errors, which always crop up at unexpected occasions, in somewhat new forms, in hitherto unfamiliar garb or surroundings, in an unusual, a more or less unusual, situation. Anarchism was not infrequently a kind of penalty for the opportunist sins of working-class movement. The two monstrosities complemented each other. And if in Russia, despite the more petty bourgeois composition of her population as compared with the other European countries, anarchism's influence was negligible during the two revolutions of 1905 and 1917, and the preparations for them, this should no doubt stand partly to the credit of Bolshevism, which has always waged a most ruthless and uncompromising struggle against opportunism. I say partly, since of still greater importance is weakening anarchism's influence in Russia, was the circumstance that in the past, the 70s of the 19th century, it was able to develop inordinately and to reveal its absolute erroneousness, its unfitness to serve the revolutionary class as a guiding theory. The struggle that Bolshevism waged against left deviations within its own party assumed particularly large proportions on two occasions. In 1908, on the question of whether or not to participate in a most reactionary, quote-unquote, parliament, and in the legal workers' societies, which were being restricted by most reactionary laws, and again in 1918, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, on the question of whether one compromise or another was permissible.
It just drew some parallels in the text between the right opportunists and the ultra-left as far as tendencies and how they complement each other. Why do we describe anarchism as a petty bourgeois tendency?
First of all, anarchism comes from individualism. It always has, it always will, and even in the future, it's going to be the same thing. It comes from individualism. Anarchism seems to fan the flames of individualism. Politically, ideologically, come out in anarchism. If you know anything about the movement called Occupy Wall Street, that was a good example of that.
Lenin also outlined in this work that the petty bourgeois also focus on this or that type of feature of capitalism, and then also through their class position, their interests prevent them from seeing the bigger picture when it comes to proletarian organization. So when they say that anarchism is petty bourgeois, it's because their class interests are preventing them from actually having a more proletarian outlook.
The significance of this book and the struggle today. I used to work in the bookstore for the CPUSA years ago, and people from the Socialist Workers' Party would come in and buy just this book or volume 26 of Lenin's collected works just so they could get this book off the shelf and other people on the left wouldn't be contaminated by it, according to their ideology.
I just thought it was really interesting that Comrade Lenin pointed out the identifying feature of ultra-leftism, or at least one of them, being the bourgeois fads that they follow, and the fact that they are, to their core, individualists, not any sort of collectivists.
I'm listening to this and thinking about how very applicable this is to what's going on. We can see in our situation in the United States that it seems like the only opposition that we have to capitalism or any type of uprisings is spontaneous ones, is anarchist ones. My question is, why do we think that it's so much more prevalent than communism or Marxist-Leninism?
I think it's a lot of things together, but if I could highlight one just off the top of my head, I'd say it's maybe survival bias, or the fact that the communists were, during the McCarthy period and several other periods of repression, just COINTELPRO, it's continuous, it comes in waves, but the people that they're less likely to touch are Trotskyists, anarchists, other ultra-left tendencies, so their organizations get left alone for the most part, or are just not eliminated totally to the same extent. So I think for that reason, in a lot of countries wherever the communist movements have failed to stand up to the repression and take serious blows, you see all kinds of ultra-left tendencies bloom.
In other words, the ultra-left is left opportunism, and Lenin refers to it as left opportunism. So now you have to ask yourself the question, what do we mean by opportunism? Opportunism in vernacular, the way we talk about it every day, basically means something comes along, if we can use it for our own advantage, we do. It's very close to what Lenin talked about, opportunism. Similar. So we have a situation where they don't have an ideology. They'll use a current fad. Look around us. We have fads every year. Look at Occupy Wall Street, a good example. They're fads. And some people on the left will take that and build on it in order to be expedient. They think they're getting to the goal closer by using the capitalist fads. Where does it come from? It comes not from the working class. It usually comes from the middle class. Petty bourgeois, as Marx would call it, small capitalists. That's where it comes from.
On the subject of the fads that seem to permeate the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie, that sounds like more of a condition of the classes themselves. And my question is, does that phenomenon affect the proletariat as we know it as well, or is there a difference?
Lenin also outlines in other works where the petty bourgeois, because of their position within capitalism, are constantly deteriorating and falling into proletarian conditions. And so as they fall into proletarian conditions, they bring with them their bourgeois ideas. As they get active in the labor movement, they take along those ideas and those class interests, and they imbue the movement
with those ideas, and that's why it's difficult and also necessary to struggle against that.
Got the survivorship bias of anarchist parties and whatnot, it's also that these parties don't really threaten the status quo. So they're pretty much left alone because the bourgeois know that they don't have to do much, that they'll fizzle out. And also we have to deal with a lot of individualist propaganda in the United States, which is why we see the prevalence of them in this country.
Lenin says that anarchism was not infrequently a kind of penalty for the opportunist sins of the working class movement. The reasoning behind him saying this is that because of the opportunism present in the movement, it led to the liquidation of the revolutionary movement. And where anarchism comes from, as well as the petty bourgeois, is that most of its behavior is also spontaneous. And so in these struggles that are manifestations of the underlying class struggle, without correct leadership, they end up resulting in the situation where people tend towards spontaneous actions and terrorist actions, which Lenin's brother was involved in. Also, Lenin says that in Russia was a circumstance that in the past it was able to develop inordinately and to reveal its absolute erroneousness. And what he's saying there is that anarchism was able to take itself to its logical end, and the masses learned from that struggle, from the objective consequences of anarchism in Russia, what it actually meant, and they learned the hard way.
Quick question about the modern definition of petty bourgeois. To my understanding, it was generally used in the past to simply refer to small capitalists like small shopkeepers or small producers. But I've heard some extend the modern definition to also mean middle managers and large capitalist firms or medium-sized capitalist firms. And I was wondering about expansion of that definition to that stratum of the population.
When we talk about the petty bourgeois, it's really people who have capital that is not as extensive as the bigger capitalists. Whole or part of their livelihood is derived from the appropriation of unpaid labor. That is who the petty bourgeois are. Now, for people who do not have capital that they derive their livelihood in the manner that I just described, but they live relatively well-off lives, very similar to the bourgeoisie, those are what we would call the labor aristocracy, or those who are a part of the upper stratum of labor. They're paid very good wages, and their interests often align with the bourgeoisie itself.
There is no modern definition, an old-fashioned definition. There's only Marx's definition. And Marx, what he said then, is going to be applied to the world today, and that's this. The connection to the means of production, that is the defining point of the petty bourgeois, the small capitalist. How close are they to the means of production? So now the next question is, what is the means of production? The means of production is factories, the labor power, and the natural resources. That's what makes up the means of production. So where is a person in their livelihood connected to the means of production? If it's not connected in any of those three places, and they basically live off their own, as one of the comrades just said, and they're not wage earners, they live off their own wits and their own place in society, not connected to the means of production. That's the middle class.
In 1908, the, quote, left Bolsheviks were expelled from our party for stubbornly refusing to understand the necessity of participating in a most reactionary, quote, parliament. The lefts, among whom there were many splendid revolutionaries who subsequently were and still are commendable members of the Communist Party, based themselves particularly on the successful experience of the 1905 boycott, when, in August 1905, the Tsar proclaimed the convocation of a consultative parliament. The Bolsheviks called for its boycott in the teeth of all the opposition parties and the Mensheviks, and the parliament was in fact swept away by the revolution of October 1905. The boycott proved correct at the time, not because non-participation in reactionary parliaments is correct in general, but because we accurately appraise the objective situation, which was leading to the rapid development of the mass strikes first into a political strike, then into a revolutionary strike, and finally into an uprising. Moreover, the struggle centered at that time on the question of whether the convocation of the first representative assembly should be left to the Tsar, or an attempt should be made to wrest its convocation from the old regime, when there was not, and could not be, any certainty that the objective situation was of a similar kind, and when there was no certainty of a similar trend and the same rate of development, the boycott was no longer correct. The Bolsheviks' boycott of Parliament in 1905 enriched the revolutionary proletariat with highly valuable political experience and showed that, when legal and illegal parliamentary and non-parliamentary forms of struggle are combined, it is sometimes useful and even essential to reject parliamentary forms. It would, however, be highly erroneous to apply this experience blindly, imitatively, and uncritically to other conditions and other situations. The Bolsheviks' boycott of the Duma in 1906 was a mistake, although a minor and easily redeemable one. The boycott of the Duma in 1907, 1908, and subsequent years was a most serious error and difficult to remedy, because, on the one hand, a very rapid rise of the revolutionary tide and its conversion into an uprising was not to be expected, and, on the other hand, the entire historical situation attendant upon the renovation of the bourgeois monarchy called for legal and illegal activities being combined. Today, when we look back at this fully completed historical period, whose connection with subsequent periods has now become quite clear, it becomes most obvious that in 1908 to 1914, the Bolsheviks could not have preserved, let alone strengthened and developed, the core of the Revolutionary Party of the proletariat, had they not upheld, in a most strenuous struggle, the viewpoint that it was obligatory to combine legal and illegal forms of struggle, and that it was obligatory to participate even in a most reactionary parliament and in a number of other institutions hemmed by reactionary laws, for example, sick benefit societies, etc.
He's talking about being obligatory to participate even in the most reactionary parliament. I'm wondering if there's any type of limit or boundary that we set when it comes to participating in electoralism. There's certain things that we will do and will not do.
Let's go back to Germany, 1932. There was a Reichstag, a parliament. The party participated in it. The only reason why the party was not there in 1934 is because they were outlawed by the Nazis. The Nazis did, from their class perspective, the correct thing. They took away the platform for the communists in the parliament to speak out on issues. They took away that. They took away our press. We couldn't reach the masses on any level. If there was a Reichstag that had allowed, of course, this sounds weird, to allow us a position, a platform, I'm convinced that the Communist Party and Lenin's idea would have prevailed, and we would have been using the Reichstag as a platform to criticize Nazi policies.
It's so important that we don't make these instances of success generalities for how we should operate. Just because one thing works at one time doesn't mean that it's always going to work. And the Bolsheviks learned that. They learned it through science of succeeding and failing. We've got to be careful of this idea, because if we're applying these generalities instead of taking each situation as it comes, then we as a party lose the ability to adapt.
Mao, who young people have historically referred to with different quotes, most of them which I find not really revolutionary, but just common sense. One of the things he said many, many years ago in the mountains of China, that we have to go where the fishes are. Lenin said we have to go where the masses are. If the masses are in X, we should be in that X, not because we agree with it, but to offer the masses or the fishes, the school of fishes that are there, a different interpretation. a different understanding. So that's why it's important to be involved where the bourgeois society controls the medium. We don't expect to use the ballot box to ever get to socialism. That's the difference between us and people who sold their soul, like the CPUSA leadership, who think that through the Democratic Party and elections, we're going to get to socialism. That is so ridiculous and naive. But we can use that medium in order to reach people and tell them our message. And that's the real reason we get involved, not to win, but to use it as a platform.
The 1905 revolution. At first, that revolution was growing and growing, and the Tsar, he started a Duma in order to stop it. And Lenin said, no, we're not going to participate in that, and he was right. And then a few months later, it was an uprising in Moscow with a lot of dead. They fought in the streets, but it was a failure. They got beaten. After that, no more revolution. It went down and down and down. And then it was the right thing to do to participate to that parliament because you were weak. When you're strong, you don't need to compromise. When you're weak, no choice. You got to.
Currently, we're seeing the PRO Act move through the government here. I think personally that this is something we should be backing, and this is one of those things that has a real opportunity to make some conditions better for the working class. Is this an example of one of the fights that the Bolsheviks would have wanted to take?
It comes under the jurisdiction of what Lenin called revolutionary reforms and reforms that the system, the capitalist system, can accept. But they would be reforms that can help the working class. The legislation is very important. We've been pushing people writing to their representatives and pushing the PRO Act because it's the best thing since the 1930s and early 40s. So yeah, you're correct on that. But it would come under the jurisdiction, in my opinion, of communists fighting for reforms that the system can accept. The system can accept certain things. Other things they can't. For example, do you think the system could accept a society without free enterprise? I don't believe that at all. Do you think the system can accept reforms that allow LGBT people to marry? Yes, because it would not touch the economic foundation of the system.
Should revolutionaries work in reactionary trade unions? We cannot but regard as equally ridiculous and childish nonsense the pompous, very learned, and frightfully revolutionary disquisitions of the German lefts to the effect that communists cannot and should not work in reactionary trade unions, that it is permissible to turn down such work, that it is necessary to withdraw from the trade unions and create a brand new, immaculate, quote-unquote, workers' union, invented by very pleasant and probably for the most part very youthful communists, etc. We are waging a struggle against the labor aristocracy in the name of the masses of the workers, and in order to win them over to our side, we are waging the struggle against the opportunist and social chauvinist leaders in order to win the working class over to our side. It would be absurd to forget this most elementary and most self-evident truth. Yet it is this very absurdity that the German left communists perpetuate when, because of the reactionary and counter-revolutionary character of the trade union top leadership, they jump to the conclusion that we must withdraw from the trade unions, refuse to work in them, and create new and artificial forms of labor organization. This is so unpardonable a blunder that it is tantamount to the greatest service communists could render the bourgeoisie. Like all the opportunist, social chauvinist, and Kautskyite trade union leaders, our Mensheviks are nothing but agents of the bourgeoisie in the working class movement, as we have always said the Mensheviks are, or, quote, labor lieutenants of the capitalist class, end quote. To use the splendid and profoundly true expression of the followers of Daniel de Leon in America, to refuse to work in the reactionary trade unions
means leaving the insufficiently developed or backward masses of workers under the influence of the reactionary leaders, the agents of the bourgeoisie, the labor aristocrats, or, quote, workers who have become completely bourgeois, end quote. And that's from Engels' letter to Marx in 1858 about the British workers. This ridiculous, quote, theory that communists should not work in reactionary trade unions reveals with the utmost clarity the frivolous attitude of the left communists towards the question of influencing the masses, their misuse of clamor about the masses. If you want to help the masses and win the sympathy and support of the masses, you should not fear difficulties or pinpricks, chicanery, insults, and persecution from the leaders, who, being opportunists and social chauvinists, are in most cases directly or indirectly connected with the bourgeoisie and the police, but must absolutely work wherever the masses are to be found. You must be capable of any sacrifice, of overcoming the greatest obstacles in order to carry on agitation and propaganda systematically, perseveringly, persistently, and patiently in those institutions, societies, and associations, even the most reactionary, in which proletarian or semi-proletarian masses are to be found. The trade unions and the workers' cooperatives, the latter sometimes at least, are the very organizations in which the masses are to be found.
Lenin is talking about left, quote-unquote, communists, and I know when we refer to it today, we call it the ultra-left. I was wondering if there is a key distinction between those terms, or if they're the same, or if there are any differences, what are the key points of delineation between what Lenin would consider left communism and then the term ultra-leftism that we use today?
Ultra-leftists today can have a broader meaning. What Lenin's talking about here are the left communists, and he's referring to those within the Marxist movement in the world at the time. But when we use the word ultra-leftist today, it can have a different meaning. For example, all left communists could be considered ultra-leftists, but not all ultra-leftists could be considered left communists, insofar as what Lenin's describing. For example, anarchists are not communists, but we would call them ultra-leftists because they see themselves as far more revolutionary. Or we could say Maoists are left communists because they call themselves communists. They consider themselves a part of the communist movement. So there is a difference between ultra-leftists and left communists. I want to mention from Stalin's industrialization of the country and the right deviation in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Bolshevik. He says, if the right say, let the kulak alone, allow him to develop freely, and the lefts, on the contrary, declare, strike not only at the kulak, but also at the middle peasant, because he is as much a private owner as the kulak, it must be admitted that there is obviously a difference. There you have a picture of the specific platform and the specific methods of the lefts. This, in fact, explains why the lefts sometimes succeed in luring a part of the workers over to their side with the help of high-sounding left phrases and by posing as the most determined opponents of the rights. Although all the world knows that they, the lefts, have the same social roots as the rights, and that they not infrequently join in an agreement, a bloc with the rights, in order to fight the Leninist line. That is why it is obligatory for us, Leninists, to wage a fight on two fronts, both against the right deviation and against the left deviation.
What Lenin's talking about here with trade unions and ultra-leftism could bring up a good point about an organization such as the IWW. It was founded to be a specifically radical trade union that incorporates all workers, but in doing so, they split many of the radical workers from trade unions where the workers generally were. So now it creates the problem of all of the radical workers move towards one place, and then they can't radicalize other workers who are in trade unions. Who are you radicalizing if you're joining the IWW? You're around other radicals.
I understand that it is saying we must work within any and all trade unions and that we shouldn't stray away from any just because they are reactionary and try to build our own. But did not the old Communist Party, the CPUSA, help build many of the trade unions
And is this because there wasn't enough unions at the time, or is this an example of them attempting to build their own because they were too reactionary?
If you're referring to the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, that was actually helped by the old CP. It was actually formed from leaders within the AFL who were pushing to organize the unorganized. In a lot of ways, it was a consequence or it was a reaction from the labor leaders in the AFL, the reactionary union leaders in the AFL, who refused to organize the unorganized. But the Communist Party did help the CIO, and it was a leading force within pushing for the CIO to organize and gave it a lot of militancy. But it was also a leading force in bringing together the CIO with the AFL again.
The revolution happened in 1917. The party was formed in 1919. In Canada, England, 1920, 21, that same period of time. During the 20s, we went through what was later admitted to be an ultra-left phase. This is what William Z. Forster mentions in his book, History of the Communist Party. It was a phase in which, internationally, we had a group called the Red International Trade Union Movement. In this country, we had Red Industrial Union. We had a group called the Needle Trades Industrial Union. It was part of this Red Unions, and they were part of the Red International. What we did is we were only attracting left workers. We were not reaching the main fishes in the ocean. Like Mao had said, swim along the fishes. We were avoiding the fishes, and we were going just to people who were similar to us. That was all changed. When the Popular Front period happened, the precedence to that 1933 onward, we were already building the CIO. The CIO was not a red situation. We were working with average workers building an industrial, notice the same name. We were building industrial unions, but we were not calling them red. And that's the difference. We went through that phase in the 20s, and it didn't produce anything. So in the 30s, we went in the other direction, and look what happened. Out of the 18 CIO unions, 11 were led by members of the Central Committee of the party.
The union membership today in the United States is nothing like how it was back in the 30s. Is there an imminent plan to try to increase union membership or the amount of unions to be like it was back in the 30s? Because it seems like for the Bolsheviks back then, getting in touch with the vast amount of union laborers was quite essential to their success in revolution.
So at this time, during the formation of the CIO, there was actually an issue with the AFL, who refused to get skilled labor out of the petty handicraft industries. They would not touch the factories. They would not touch unskilled labor. And that's really what the CIO focused on, because it was a vast amount of workers who were unorganized. And that's really what we need today, a new situation where the workers and the struggle against the reactionary union leadership within the major unions who are refusing to take on the trustified industries, we need that situation to happen so that we can open up the possibility for the workers to finally be able to unionize.
About the bourgeois parliament, the Russian Revolution, they had three stages. 1905, which was a bourgeois revolution, was a failure. Then February 1917, bourgeois revolution, which grew into a proletarian revolution, October 17. Now, there was this constituent assembly. There was a demand of the first revolution of 1905 and the second one of February 17. And Bolsheviks were behind it, no problem. Also, the main slogan was all power to the Soviets. Well, it turned out that 11 million armed proletarians and peasants put the Bolsheviks in power in October 17. So 2 months later, the Constituent Assembly gathered for one day, and Lenin said, "We aren't going back to a bourgeois parliament. We got the Soviets." And they dissolved it the same day or the next day. And it's funny how they did. The Red Guard said, man, we need some sleep. We're going to close it down. They never came back.
I thought this passage was really poignant when the comrade was reading, and I think it speaks to a misconception that we can have as communists analyzing trade unions. And some people have this mistaken understanding that those in trade unions already have socialist leanings or socialist tendencies. People in trade unions, as the text just said, it is where the masses are to be found. So we have people in trade unions, people who vote for Trump, people who vote for Biden, people who vote third party, libertarian, whatever the case is. So Lenin calls these laboratories for communism or something to that effect. So I think it speaks to the idea that a trade union as an organization and as a structure lends itself to communist practice, organization, and agitation. But just because trade unions exist doesn't mean that they are automatically tending toward a socialist leaning.
In state and revolution and also imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism by Lenin, this particular phase of state monopoly capitalism, there is no any qualitative distinction between the people's representatives, like people who run for Congress in this country and in the Senate, and the multinational corporations who are dominating the economic life, cultural life, and spiritual life of the country as a whole. Actually, the people's representatives themselves are millionaires and billionaires who are conduits between voters and the corporate system and big banks. They just go there to negotiate some kickbacks or crumbs from the corporate system. Otherwise, it is very difficult to say that in the state monopoly capitalist stage of development that there are voters, because in the case of America, 80% of Americans do not know what's happening in this country and overseas. They don't even read the newspapers. So I think, in conclusion, this stage of development of capitalism is stakeholders and opportunists and career politicians in the interest, who run in the interest of the people, but they are totally controlled by the corporation. They do not represent the people in any sense of the term.
It's really been recently that I've been studying and learning about what trade unions exactly are. And I was in a meeting yesterday with some comrades, and we were discussing unions in general. And something that I learned is that most of the unions in this country are liberal at best. A lot of them are very staunch Democrat unions. And I had my own experience with a reactionary union where I was working for a company, Target. And when I was working there, I wanted to try and unionize some of my fellow workers in the warehouse. And my bosses were very upset with me about that. As Comrade Lenin was pointing out, that it's important to work where the workers are, regardless of if they're already socialist or communist or not.
I just wanted to make sure that what we're looking at is working within the unions, whether or not we feel like we're going to be agreeing with them on everything right off the bat, because this is where the workers are, and we can change some of the ideals later, but we need to work with the masses.
I want to make this clear, this comment is very important. When I joined the party officially when I was 18, I joined with the understanding that I was going to go into the teaching field and join a union in New York City, the United Federation of Teachers, UFT, which is local too of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT. And that's exactly what I did. Now, the problem is that I would bet you that 90% of the people on this phone call, maybe 98%, are not members of unions, have never even thought of that work, and therefore they're letting the key area of work go by. I think that's a mistake, a big, big mistake. In the United Federation of Teachers, we had a union in 1936 that the Socialist Party controlled called the New York Teachers Union, and that was started in 1916. In 1936, the communists took over the leadership of the New York Teachers Union, and we led the struggle. We did not get collective bargaining. Collective bargaining means that the employer, in this case the city of New York, recognizes that you represent the teachers. We didn't get it. The people that got it were a group around Albert Schenker, who basically formed the United Federation of Teachers. The New York Teachers Union was let go, and we all went into the United Federation of Teachers, all the communists. and we worked, and we ran union elections every 3 years. We ran a slate of candidates against the union leadership, and that's how communists do work inside unions. You have to actually join other communists and run candidates against the leadership, which, as Comrade Lenin clearly pointed out, they're part of the labor aristocracy.
These facts make crystal clear something that is confirmed by thousands of other symptoms, namely that class consciousness and the desire for organization are growing among the proletarian masses, among the rank and file, among the backward elements. Millions of workers in Great Britain, France, and Germany are for the first time passing from a complete lack of organization to the elementary, lowest, simplest, and to those still thoroughly imbued with the bourgeois democratic prejudices, most easily comprehensible form of organization, namely the trade unions. Yet the revolutionary but imprudent left communists stand by, crying out the masses, but refusing to work within the trade unions on the pretext that they are reactionary, and invent a brand new, immaculate little workers' union which is guiltless of bourgeois democratic prejudices and innocent of craft or narrow-minded craft union sins. A union which, they claim, will be a broad organization. Quote, recognition of the Soviet system and the dictatorship, end quote, will be the only condition of membership. It would be hard to imagine any greater ineptitude or greater harm to the revolution than that caused by the left revolutionaries. Why? If we in Russia today, after 2.5 years of unprecedented victories over the bourgeoisie of Russia and the Entente, were to make recognition of the dictatorship a condition of the trade union membership, we would be doing a very foolish thing, damaging our influence among the masses and helping the Mensheviks. The task devolving on communists is to convince the backward elements to work among them and not to fence themselves off from them with artificial and childishly left slogans. Now, should we participate in bourgeois parliaments? That's a question. It is with the utmost contempt and the utmost levity that the German left communists reply to this question in the negative. Their arguments, in the passage quoted above, we read, all reversion to parliamentary forms of struggle, which have become historically and politically obsolete, must be emphatically rejected. This is said with ridiculous pretentiousness and is patently wrong. Reversion to parliamentarism, forsooth. Perhaps there is already a Soviet Republic in Germany. It does not look like it. How then can one speak of quote-unquote reversion? Is this not an empty phrase? Parliamentarism has become historically obsolete. That is true in the propaganda sense. However, still a far cry from overcoming it in practice. Capitalism could have been declared, and with full justice, to be, quote, historically obsolete many decades ago. But that does not at all remove the need for a very long and very persistent struggle on the basis of capitalism. Parliamentarism is historically obsolete from the standpoint of world history. That is, the era of bourgeois parliamentarism is over, and the era of proletarian dictatorship has begun. That is incontestable, but world history is counted in decades. 10 or 20 years earlier or later makes no difference when measured with the yardstick of world history. From the standpoint of world history, it is a trifle that cannot be considered even approximately. But for that very reason, it is a glaring theoretical error to apply the yardstick of world history to practical politics. Is parliamentarism politically obsolete? That is quite a different matter. If that were true, the position of the lefts would be a strong one, but it has to be proved by a most searching analysis. And the lefts do not even know how to approach the matter. In the, quote, Theses on Parliamentarism, published in the Bulletin of the Provisional Bureau in Amsterdam of the Communist International No. 1, February 1920, and obviously expressing the Dutch left or left Dutch strivings, the analysis, as we shall see, is also hopelessly poor. In the first place,
contrary to the opinion of such outstanding political leaders as Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, the German left, as we know, considered parliamentarism politically obsolete even in January 1919. We know that the lefts were mistaken. This fact alone utterly destroys, at a single stroke, the proposition that parliamentarism is politically obsolete. It is for the left to prove why their error, indisputable at that time, is no longer an error. They do not and cannot produce even a shred of proof. A political party's attitude towards its own mistakes is one of the most important and surest ways of judging how earnest the party is and how it fulfills in practice its obligations towards its class and the working people. Frankly acknowledging a mistake, ascertaining the reasons for it, analyzing the conditions that have led up to it, and thrashing out the means of its rectification, that is the hallmark of a serious party. That is how it should perform its duties, and how it should educate and train its class, and then the masses. By failing to fulfill this duty, and give the utmost attention and consideration to the study of their patent error, the left in Germany and in Holland have proved that they are not the party of a class, but of a circle. Not a party of the masses, but of a group of intellectualists, and of a few workers who are the worst features of intellectualism.
It may take a little abstracting here for what Lenin's talking about, but he's also outlining the very foundation of the ultra-leftist tendency to split over minor differences and to form these perfect revolutionary organizations. To learn more about this, I encourage everyone to read William Z. Foster on dual unions. But back to what Lenin's saying here, it's a very clear outline of the behavior and tendencies of the ultra-leftists and left communists who, like in today's reality, there are many organizations who call themselves revolutionary, call themselves socialist and communist. And this is ultimately where this type of behavior comes from refusal to engage in the political struggle within their organizations and to split over these childish things.
I remember taking history in high school. And in Africa, history is just you memorize and pass the test. But I never understood what the word Entente meant. I think it was an alliance of some European countries against the Bolshevik revolutions. And I wonder if one of you could explain to me how many countries were in the Entente and what were their significance vis-a-vis the Great October Socialist Revolution.
World War I, that's what it's about. There were two sides, Austria-Hungary on one side, and basically England on the other. And each one led a formation. The Triple Entente, there were three countries working on that side, and on the other side, there were three countries. That's what the word Entente means. Its connection to revolution is obvious. Remember the famous quote from Lenin, "To every imperialist war are the seeds of social revolution." That is so clear. When the soldiers were coming back from World War I in Russia, defeated at the battle, that gave impetus to have a social revolution. That's why one of the three things that the Bolsheviks offered the people were peace. That was the first one, peace. In other words, get the hell out of World War I. The other one was bread, and the other one was land. So that's what the Triple Entente meant. Its effect on social revolution was obvious. I hope I answered you. Thank you.
I understand the importance of going to the people and participating in even sometimes reactionary trade unions. Is not participating in these trade union elections the same situation as with bourgeois parliamentarian elections, where the communists will always be repressed by the bourgeois state apparatus, even in these trade unions? And what is the solution to participating in these institutions and reaching the masses, but at the same time actually gaining state power and leading them towards revolutionary organizations?
Get away from the computer. I hate to tell you this. Get out of your house. Get off the couch. Get away from the computer. Go out into the streets where the people are. I know it's uncomfortable. I went through this. If you're a person that tends to be a loner, it's uncomfortable. but we need to get out there. We need to set up tables in the community. We need to join a union. If there's no union, we need to try to start a union. Once the union's starting, we have to run for office with other people in the union, run candidates that are of our ideological persuasion, and that's the way we do it. If it's not the union and you live in a building with tenants, you form a tenants union, a student union on campus to protect the rights of students on the campus. Whatever the group is, the association, laundry workers, you form a laundry workers union. In other words, comrades, you get out of the individuality and get into the collective. That's where every Bolshevik should be. You are a failure, comrade, if you're not collectively working with people in one place or another in your community. I hate to tell you that answer. The party itself is one way of doing that. We're collective. We discuss things collectively. That's the beginning. But we have to get into where the masses are.
Comrade Angelo was right about getting off the computer. We have, in my opinion, a duty to work with and represent workers regardless of their own leanings. Because living in America at the heart of the capitalist empire, we really can't afford to splinter off into different factions and parties. I was talking earlier today with a comrade on Twitter who was mentioning that the left always seems to splinter off into smaller and smaller parties and organizations, where I think we're all missing the point. And I think Comrade Lenin was making very obvious that we have to work with the workers regardless of where they're at in their own political journey, and getting off the computer, getting out into the street and simply just talking with other people that we work with or doing propaganda work, talking about where we're at right now and forming a camaraderie with anyone that we come in contact with.
The labor aristocracy, are they more petty bourgeois or working class traders that have basically just taken the buck from the bosses?
I would say that the latter is a more appropriate characterization. More specifically and more often, the terms used for the people who have been bought off in the trade unions, but then also labor leaders who may not be necessarily in the trade unions. The primary consequence of their being is a confusion of the working class, and they become sheepdogs for the working class towards the bourgeoisie.
I wanted to add my perspective to why anarchism is so popular. I don't know if this is other comrades' personal experience, but from the anarchists that I've talked to, they seem to be still very blinded by the communism bad propaganda that has been obviously very successful in the United States for such a very long time. They hear all these lies about supposed horrible things that the USSR, Cuba, or North Korea, wherever, have done, and they see any type of authority as being bad as a result. And to bypass that, they think that we should just have a revolution and then go immediately to a classless, moneyless society. But from previous classes that we've had, we've seen that that doesn't work. I think that's another reason why anarchism is so popular here, just because of how successful the anti-communism propaganda has been in this country.
What Comrade just made was a great point, and what also came to my mind was individualism in our society and how anarchism lets you claim the cloak of revolution while still being draped in individualism and having petty bourgeois tendencies. It's a really easy way to, sounds rude, but to some extent to make yourself feel good while not having to quote-unquote apologize for the crimes of Stalin or whatever things people want to make up.
One of the things about anarchism is in anarchism or socialism, Stalin points out in many ways the anarchists are our enemy. One of them being the anarchist belief is everything for the individual, whereas the Marxist belief is everything for the masses. The individual cannot be liberated until the masses are liberated. Another thing is that a lot of these people, especially in the Occupy movement, were more interested about advancing themselves than they were about actually being connected to the masses in any way. And that's what individualism takes part in. It's about advancing oneself over the working class.
You'll notice that throughout history, the anarchist movements, almost always, if not always, has benefited the side of reaction due to their anti-communist nature.
The whole class, it's been fantastic. I'm excited to come to class every Tuesday and Thursday. I love coming here and learning with all my comrades. Seeing the parallels of what Lenin's writing about and what we're seeing even in the last 4 or 5 years, it's definitely very beneficial for all of us to just pay attention to what's going on and apply what we're reading.
This conversation about petty bourgeois and labor aristocracy made me think of how the growing gig economy in the United States is going to fit into this equation. Because I've certainly been misclassified as an independent contractor before, and I know tons of people are. And as workers' rights continue to be eroded in this country, I wonder if we're going to have a new consideration or a new category for these types of workers. I'm looking at this Forbes survey right now, and it says nearly 30% of workers are self-employed, and a sizable chunk of that are gig economy workers, freelancers who contribute significantly to the economy, but they're not factory workers. They're Uber drivers and entertainers, and I wonder how they fit into the equation.
Notice nobody has used the word that everybody has in the back of their mind when they talk about capitalists, and the word is entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship. It is instilled in this country. Everything from Shark Tank to the old president had a TV show about firing people. Everything is about being your own businessman. Even the old series called All in the Family. He was on the assembly line, and then he buys a bar. And once he buys the bar, he becomes anti-union. Because entrepreneurship, comrades, is a nice word for walking on the capitalist trail. That's what you're doing. You threw in your lot with the boss, with the capitalist. And entrepreneurship is the twin brother for individualism. And that is the big problem in this country, in the left, in society in general. They are, to me, the prime enemies against the working class.
I backed up NGOs. You could even use as a great example the so-called Uber drivers. They're supposed to be working for somebody, but they half work for themselves. They used to be a taxi industry in New York. You had taxi garages and taxi owners, and you had the drivers and drivers' unions. And then they started selling off medallions to individual drivers. Even before the so-called Uber drivers, you had a lot of drivers. Even when I was driving a cab back in the 70s, a lot of the big cab companies started selling off a lot of their medallions to their workers, and their workers became self-employed. And many of them, of course, put themselves deep in a hole, and then they spent their whole life trying to make enough money as one driver as opposed to a whole organization. Like Angelo said, people get sucked into this being your own boss type of thing. And what happens is that being your own boss doesn't work, and you wind up slaving under a capitalist society just to make do.
Responding to the success of anti-communist propaganda in the United States, I think another key reason that it's so successful is because many Americans aren't aware of the American history of inviting great numbers of assorted fascist thugs and anyone who was anti-communist. They contribute to this too. I can only speak from one example, but the people who speak about the communist government in Ethiopia, which had its faults, call back to the good old days of the monarchy. And I say, a good old day of sub 10% literacy, of actual practice slavery and medieval feudalism. These are the good old days that they're talking about. And I find that to be the same with Eastern Europeans who have anti-communist sentiments, Cuban Americans who have these sentiments. It's because we don't understand our own history of inviting these people to this country. That contributes to it. So we end up with a view of communism that's something resembling a totalitarianism, a kind of fascism without the fascism aesthetic in the popular imagination.
Ethiopia during the Derg, which is the era that you're referring to, Derg means committee the same way, like in Russian, the word Soviet means committee. During the Derg, there wasn't necessarily a worship of the monarchy. They just used the material basis of things like, for example, what Stalin used in the early Second World War of what is known as socialist patriotism,
how, for example, generals like Suvorov and Brusilov were celebrated in the Soviet Union for defending Russia, but not necessarily the regime itself. So, for example, in Ethiopia, Emperor Tedros was praised, and there was even a medal given to soldiers named after him because he reappropriated lands to the peasants, destroyed the authority of the Orthodox Church, and abolished slavery. But they still materially criticized him as being an authoritarian. The Derg, they had a historical materialist analysis that led to them saying, we identify with the Ethiopian structure, like the imperial structure, not in the sense of what it represented in Ethiopia, but specifically what we could change.
Since we're getting the idea that participation in the bourgeois parliaments, it really depends on the actual bourgeois parliament you're talking about. What is our analysis of our present bourgeois parliament?
I think us living at ground zero of the imperium, you have to understand that taking part in bourgeois electoralism has to mean that we have to be very strict with our line. I would say a non-Marxist-Leninist party we should model after is Sinn Féin in Ireland. They're elected in both England and in Northern Ireland, but they use their elected positions to advocate for progressive change in the country. I think that's the only logical step, because what happens is, if you look at the Euro-communist movement, it came from them constantly trying to work within the bourgeois system. And then they said, you know what, we'll fade our red to pink and become democratic socialists and become more appealable to the bourgeois media intellectual complex.
Comrade is correct. That's our position, to use the parliament as a platform to get our views out, because people are listening to those views during electoral periods. So comrade is really correct. But the party's position has always been the three-legged stool. The first leg is we run candidates under our own name. If we cannot do the first leg, we try the second leg. Work in an electoral front with other progressive groups to form an independent party for elections outside of the Democratic and the Republican structure. And the last leg of the stool. If we can't do the first two, then we try to support a candidate of the two major parties who is the most favorable to the working class, anti-imperialism and anti-racism. If we cannot find that, then we don't support anybody. That's the three-legged stool.
I recommend Lenin's Opportunism and the Collapse of the Second International, his Marxism and Revisionism, his Differences in the European Labor Movement, and I also recommend William Z. Foster's American Trade Unionism.
I'm going to recommend the book Socialism Betrayed by two authors, Roger Kieran and Thomas Kenny. I found it to be the best analysis of what happened in the Soviet Union, specifically during the Gorbachev years, and why it ended the way it did. What was perestroika? What was it really about? And I think if we understand that situation, we then can go into what's going on in China, because in my opinion, it has to do with not ideology, but with economics. And that's what perestroika was about. It was about economics. Ideology was thrown out the window and economics was put in the driving seat.
Great line about the difference between a communist vanguard and anarchist indications. Communist vanguard looks to reclaim labor through a dictatorship of the proletariat, where these anarchist syndications, they look to barter with capitalism using our labor as opposed to reclaiming it entirely.
Jacques Duclos, he was a historical figure of the French Communist Party at the time that it was Marxist-Leninist, of course. And at his funeral, it was on April 29th, 1975, I went there. It was incredible. 200,000 people at a cemetery where the last communard lost their life in a hand-to-hand fight against the bourgeois army. And a day later, April 30th, was the victory of Vietnam when they entered Saigon. And a day later was May 1st. And there was 1 million people in the streets of Paris. I've never seen anything like that.
A book that I want to recommend and end the class with it was published in East Germany, of all places, 1977. The title of the book is called Anti-Communist Myths in Left Disguise. The author is Robert Steiger-Wald. Really, really good. It talks about falsifications of Lenin that the left puts out. Talks about left revisionist criticism of socialism. Does that sound familiar? Bourgeois ideology in left disguise. Anti-communism, myths and mechanisms. And it even has reference notes and an index. I urge people to look for that book. It is 100 pages. What's important is that anti-communism in the so-called radical left is very big. Look at the names they choose. In 1928, they split from us. They set up a Trotskyite group. They call themselves Socialist Workers' Party. What is the word they left out? Communist. In 1959, they split from the SWP, which is a Trotskyite group. And what do they call themselves? Workers' World Party. What did they leave out? Communist. Workers' World Party splits. 20 years ago, what do they call themselves? Party for Socialism and Liberation. What did they leave out? Communism. That's not a mistake. That's a deliberate decision that was made every single time. Workers' World Party had a split last year. What do they call themselves? Struggle La Lucha. What did they leave out? Communist. 12 people left us. They deliberately formed another group. You know what they call themselves? People's Revolutionary Party. What did they leave out? Communist. That's a deliberate decision to acquiesce to anti-communism so that they didn't have to deal with it. There's only two parties in this country that still use the name. One of them doesn't believe in it anymore, and they're called the Communist Party USA. The other one is called the Party of Communists USA. I want to bring that up because it's very important. People run away from the word, even in the left. Even so-called revolutionaries run away from that word. Thank you for coming to tonight's class. I hope everybody learned something. Remember the words of Maurice Bishop in the Grenada Revolution. Forward, ever. Backward, never. Thank you, comrades. Good night.
Thank you for watching this full-length class from the People's School for Marxist-Leninist Studies. For more information, or if you're interested in attending classes, visit our website, check out our YouTube channel, or email info@psmls.org.